Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not like he's been lying to us. I mean, the man is the chairman of the Federal Reserve. But when Ben Bernanke spoke today, somehow the magic was gone. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually, and working for an energy-independent America. Publictransportation.org. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
From the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C., I'm Kai Rizdahl. So glad to have you with us today. The date's the 18th of July. The chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States spent some quality time with Congress today. If you've been paying attention, you'll recall Mr. Bernanke's been saying for a good long while now that although inflation's his main worry, he's sure it's all going to be okay in the end. Today, he wasn't quite so sanguine. He said the trend we've been seeing of core inflation holding steady might just be temporary. Core inflation, of course, being the number that doesn't even count food and energy costs. He had some other things on his mind, too, that gross domestic product is going to be kind of so-so for the rest of the year and into next. And that whole subprime mortgage thing, we're not done yet.
Rising delinquencies and foreclosures are creating personal, economic, and social distress for many homeowners and communities, problems that likely will get worse before they get better.
Speaking of which, this one broke late yesterday afternoon. You might have missed it. Bear Stearns admitted two of its hedge funds that have been battered by the mess in subprimes, once worth $1.5 billion all told, have essentially evaporated. The bonds those funds invested in, and most other corporate bonds too, are evaluated or graded by credit rating agencies, companies you've heard of like Standard & Poor's and Moody's. AAA is good, junk is bad. This week, Moody's made it harder to get that A, and now it says it's losing business. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay reports.
Moody's is worried about the kind of bonds that are backed by pools of commercial mortgages. The bondholders get their money when mortgage holders make their monthly payments. The bonds are rated on a scale. The most secure are rated AAA, and they get paid first. The least secure get junk ratings, and they get paid last. If a large number of people fail to make their mortgage payments, the lower-rated bonds will default. There might not even be enough money to pay the AAA bonds. So in April, Moody's told issuers of these bonds not to create so many AAAs. Tad Phillip is a managing director at Moody's. He wants to make sure the AAA bonds that are issued are more secure. But today, he said that bond issuers are turning away from Moody's.
We have lost about 75% of the deals. Normally, we would rate 75%. Recently, we have been missing 75%. So our market share has done a backflip lately.
Phillip says he's trying to protect investors. Paul Fiorilla is managing editor of Commercial Mortgage Alert. He says Moody's has turned off issuers who are worried that tougher ratings will make their bond business less profitable.
Well, it kind of highlights the whole inherent conflict in the whole rating agency business. If Moody's or any agency is too harsh in the way it rates deals, it loses business.
Fiorilla says it's not clear how much more stringent the new measures by Moody's are compared to other agencies. But by bypassing Moody's and going to S&P and Fitch, issuers are proving to investors that not all A ratings are the same. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
The Federal Trade Commission heard today from food companies that market to kids, and the mere mention of government regulations prompted those companies to crack down on themselves. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
An all-time favorite kid cereal still beloved by many adults is Captain Crunch. General Mills even has a website that features interactive games with the chunky captain.
Ready? Good. But under the new self-imposed industry rules, the captain's website will be shuttered. 11 companies have pledged to limit junk food ads to kids under 12. PepsiCo, maker of Lay's and Cheetos, will stop using characters in TV ads unless they're touting a healthy product. And McDonald's will only promote Happy Meals that weigh in under 600 calories. Is that even possible?
That's a four-piece chicken McNuggets plus apple dippers and low-fat white milk. It comes to 375 calories.
Mary Engels with the FTC. She says the agency's encouraged by the industry's initiatives. Analyst Matthew Riley with Morningstar says these food titans do fear government regulation, but the real reason for the self-imposed limits is PR.
They want to be seen as really caring about their customers, not pushing junk food on kids.
Riley says these companies dominate distribution, so they're going to sell product despite the ad limits. That's why ad critic Gene Kilbourn is calling for Congress to step up.
What the government needs are uniform guidelines and oversight from a government agency that has real authority. And that's difficult to do when industries give so much money to politicians.
The FTC will work up a report on today's hearing and present it to Congress early next year. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Until the bell this afternoon, it had been four records in a row for the Dow. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. U.S. and African trade officials are meeting today in Ghana. They're reviewing a trade deal called the African Growth and Opportunity Act. The basic idea was to get rid of U.S. tariffs on goods manufactured in sub-Saharan Africa and so expand the market for products that desperately need a market. Trouble is, it wasn't just sub-Saharan countries that negotiators should have been thinking about when they wrote it. From South Africa, Gretchen Wilson reports.
At the Peak Trade clothing factory here in Newcastle, 200 women are piecing together T-shirts, 70 per hour each. Talking's generally forbidden. I'm looking for Tabile Dahile. You'd think finding a gray-haired, aging woman here would be easy to spot. But there are so many older women here, I can't see her. She's asked me not to approach her if I do, because she's afraid she'll lose her job. If you listen closely, you'll understand what many workers here see as part of the problem. The machinists and ironers here are Zulu women, but the owners aren't South African, they're from Shanghai. In Newcastle, many men are unemployed or have left for jobs in other towns as miners or truckers. So those working in the factories are all women. Most of their families only breadwinners, and about a third, like Tahile, are grannies, who traditionally would be home with the family. Tahile earns 44 cents an hour, less than half the minimum wage, which is rarely enforced here.
It's so little what we earn. I can't even build myself a house. Even grocery, when I get paid, I can only afford corn meal. And with what's left over, I can't buy meat or vegetable to go with it. Our wages are not enough.
At night, Dahile returns to the two-room shack she shares with her daughter and granddaughter. She wants electricity and plumbing, but as she sweeps the plastic sheet that covers her dirt floor, she says factory owners take advantage of young and old South Africans alike.
The management is not treating us well. Sometimes they don't count your work properly. They don't count all of it, so they can rob you.
Still, with so few jobs here, she has no other choice. Dozens of Chinese factories set up shop in Newcastle after 2000. That's when U.S. Congress passed AGOA. It's another example of how Chinese firms have capitalized on U.S. trade incentives elsewhere. China's now making cars in Mexico that come to the U.S. tax-free. In 2005, the world scrapped a quota system that protected clothing producers. That meant African companies had to compete directly with Chinese firms. Predictably, China got the upper hand. Still, Newcastle keeps trying to woo foreign companies. Economic Development Director Ferdy Alberts.
Irrespective of the bad publicity and some trade by them not complying with labor legislation, we are grateful for what they have done for our local economy.
It could be worse. Actually, it is. 25-year-old Fikile Butelezi says she can't afford to buy the clothes she makes. They're sold at local department stores.
Sometimes it hurts to see someone wearing a T-shirt that you know is difficult to make. Your boss was over you, shouting at you, and the person wearing it now is walking down the street enjoying herself. But at the same time, it's nice to see something my hands have made.
Those are 40 rand, those are 30 rand, those are 25 francs.
Friday's payday at Newcastle's factories. Women file out of the gate and into the street. It's crowded with hawkers selling clothing pulled from plastic bags, jeans for $8, sweaters for $1.50. There's loads of it. And, yep, you guessed it, it's all imported from China. In Newcastle, South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Well-heeled American businessmen have been dressing themselves in suits by Hickey Freeman for more than a century now. The company is one of the only truly American suit makers still in business. It's refused to outsource production like most of its competitors have done, and employees still do much of the work by hand. Hickey Freeman's good relations with its workers and its hometown have helped it survive, but the company still had to make some unconventional adjustments. From New York, Daniel Weiss reports on how an American classic has managed to stay in style.
It's the time of year when you could fry an egg on the sidewalk in New York's financial district. But lucky for Hickey Freeman, people are still buying suits.
Shoulders fit nice here.
In the air-conditioned calm of Hickey Freeman's Wall Street store, Phil Kornblatt, resplendent in a tan vest and French cuffs, is helping a customer into a pinstripe jacket.
When it's altered, it'll button like that. And then we'll have the
Kornblatt's customer, Mark Bailey, is outfitting himself for a new banking job. In all, Bailey drops just under $3,000 for two suits, two ties, four shirts, and a belt. Not bad for a Brit who'd never even heard of Hickey Freeman the day before.
Well, we actually came by yesterday, didn't know the store existed, and came in. The quality looks good, the prices look good, and the service has been excellent. And to be honest, I was a little bit taken by the fact that they're made in the state. So that sort of piqued my interest in coming back today.
Hickey Freeman's suits have been made in the same Rochester, New York factory since 1912. The company's 640 employees transform bolts of fine fabric and lining into hand-finished jackets and trousers. Duffy Hickey is chairman of Hickey Freeman. He's also the grandson of one of the founders. He says Hickey Freeman has outlasted hundreds of other local clothing companies by refusing to compromise on luxury.
We were the only ones that through the 30s and the 40s and the 50s stuck to producing a quality garment. All the rest kind of fluctuated with the marketplace, and they're no longer here.
Hickey Freeman had a near miss a few years ago. Its factory was in such bad shape, it almost had to move to Chicago, home base of its parent company, Hartmarks. But Rochester and New York State were horrified at the thought of losing such a good, long-standing employer. They ponied up $5 million toward a sprinkler system and new wiring. Unite Here, the employees' union, kicked in another $500,000 for air conditioning. Mike Roberts is the union's upstate chief of staff.
Our obligations to our members entail obligations to their employers. In this kind of industry, in manufacturing in general, you've got to be able to work creatively and cooperatively with these employers, or we'll all lose. We won't be able to keep these jobs in the United States.
Hickey Freeman has cemented its foundation in Rochester, but constant threats like business casual and overseas competition have forced the company to be nimble. It recently rolled out a new line called Little Hickey to appeal to a younger, hipper clientele. Along with an array of fashion-forward suits, Little Hickey features ties, shirts, and pants embroidered with marijuana leaves and silhouettes of naked women. You know, the kind you see on truck mudflaps. Duffy Hickey says he doesn't quite get it. The first time he saw one of the marijuana leaf motifs, he mistook it for a maple leaf.
I couldn't understand why we were trying to promote Canada by putting this maple leaf on the front of a sweater. And they looked at me and said, "Are you sure you understand what that is?" And I said, "Well, isn't that a maple leaf?" And they said, "No, it's not."
Hickey may be 70 years old, but he was quick to adjust his business to accommodate the taste of downtown hipsters as well as the titans of Wall Street. Stephen Bible works at Scoop Men's in Manhattan's trendy meatpacking district. He says the Little Hickey designs sell well, and not just to the younger crowd.
I've seen all kinds of guys just come in here and be like, oh, I like this with the hemp leaf, or I like this naked girl thing. I want this shirt. And sometimes it's surprising who will come in and pick those shirts up.
The Little Hickey line has helped boost Hickey Freeman's numbers. The company's performance has been so good that parent company Heartmarks has begun to favor it over the lower-priced brands in the Heartmarks stable. A new Hickey Freeman store will open in San Francisco in the fall, and Little Hickey will get a shop of its own in New York Soho. In New York, I'm Daniel Weiss for Marketplace.
We've got some pictures of the Hickey Freeman factory in Rochester on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, Hollywood's take on the ad game.
Occasionally it's about what you're afraid of. Occasionally it's about what you don't want to think about. But for the most part, it's our idealized selves.
But first, let's do the numbers. Blame it on Bernanke or blame more subprime jitters. Lackluster profit reports didn't help either. They all factored into a negative number for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which fell 53 points, about a third of 1%, to end at 13,918. The NASDAQ lost 12 points, nearly half a percent, finished at 26.99. The S&P 500 shaved off 3 points, 2-tenths of 1% there, wrapped up trading at 15.46. Surprising news of a sharp drop in U.S. petroleum inventories pumped up prices by a buck a barrel, which in turn boosted stock in the big oil companies. Shares of ExxonMobil and Chevron each gushed up more than 2%. Stock in ConocoPhillips spurted up more than 1.5%. Disappointing results from a couple of technology bellwethers weighed on the NASDAQ. Shares of Intel and Yahoo each dropped 4.8%. That after their quarterly profit reports yesterday failed to click with investors. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 5.03%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by American Public Media's weekly program, Speaking of Faith. Starting July 19th, Krista Tippett explores the ethics of eating with author Barbara Kingsolver, speakingoffaith.org. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board reports its monthly index of leading economic indicators. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke presents the semiannual monetary policy report to the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. And nominations for the 59th Annual Primetime Emmy Awards are announced tomorrow morning in Los Angeles. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was more in that inflation report this morning than just news of rising prices. Worker wages went up as well, 0.5%, and that's after adjusting for inflation. What it doesn't adjust for, though, is the sinking influence of organized labor. Last month, Senate Republicans blocked a Democratic proposal to help unions organize in private sector companies. Commentator David Frum says in the long-running battle over unions, we've forgotten whether they're relevant.
A wonderful joke from the 1960s has a grizzled ex-communist listening to a bright-eyed new leftist. The new leftist goes on and on about Marx and Mao and collective farms until finally the ex-communist wearily replies, "Son, your answers are so old, I've forgotten the questions." When it comes to the ancient debate over unions, the question is, what exactly do they do? Two economists presented the classic answer to this question more than two decades ago. Richard Freeman and James Medoff concluded that unions do raise wages. More important, Freeman and Medoff explained how unions do it. Contrary to what you might expect, the firms where unions score the greatest success are not those with the most market power. Microsoft, for instance, has enormous market power. It can charge a very high price for its products without fear of losing market share to a competitor. Yet Microsoft is famously ununionized. The firms where unions score are ones with heavy fixed investments. Tangible investments, like the huge factories of a General Motors, or intangible, like the gates and landing rights of a United Airlines. Unions can, in effect, tax those investments and force companies to accept lower rates of profit, sharing more of their proceeds with employees instead. The trouble for unions is that in our modern world, companies are mobile. They look more like Microsoft, less like General Motors. Workers have lost out, and legislation cannot alter that fact. We need newer answers. Workers are losing in part because healthcare costs are rising so fast. In fact, healthcare gobbled up all the increase in compensation in the past 6 years. And less skilled workers are losing to the huge influx of immigration since 2000. Probably 8 million workers, at least half of them illegal. Control immigration, contain healthcare costs. That will do more for American labor than any union or any union legislation.
David Frum is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. If you have some comments you'd like to share with us, send them along through our website. It's marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. Even though Hollywood's just up the freeway from where we are in Los Angeles, we don't get to mingle with the stars all that often. But we got a chance last week with a trip to the set of Mad Men. It's a new hour-long drama series that debuts tomorrow on AMC, set in the capital of 1960s advertising, New York's Madison Avenue, a time and a place where men made the big decisions and women took notes and made the coffee, or just as often set out the cocktail shaker in the ice. And to be an ad executive was to be at the very top of the corporate food chain. We sat down with the show's creator, Matt Weiner, in the conference room of his fictional ad agency.
And action.
What Lee Jr. said is right. If you can't make those health claims, neither can your competitors.
So we got a lot of people not saying anything that sells cigarettes.
Not exactly. This is the greatest advertising opportunity since the invention of cereal. We have six identical companies making six identical products. We can say anything we want.
And cut. Okay, good.
Cut.
The first episode opens with Don Draper, the creative director at Sterling & Cooper, your ad agency that you've created, having trouble with a cigarette account. Lucky Strike, the iconic American cigarette. Why'd you pick that?
I picked Lucky Strike because I wanted to have a real brand in there and because there was a crisis in cigarette advertising that coincided with first a report in the mid-50s, I think in 56 or something, where it was basically acknowledged that cigarettes were dangerous. The cigarette industry's response was to start putting filters on and starting advertising whose was the most healthy. And then the government said, you can't say that anymore. You can't have doctors anymore. So they were at a crisis. How are we going to sell this product? But it took Don out of a moral question and put him into a selling question. And the selling question then becomes about him and about what we want and about how we feel about ourselves. And that just seemed to be just a very rich area to me.
And he makes a great speech and he says, advertising is based on one thing,
happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay.
Has that changed at all since 1960?
I don't think so. I'm not in the advertising business, but I am a fan of it. I think that a lot of our great entertainment, even though we deny it, comes from advertising. We love good ads. Occasionally, it's about what you're afraid of. Occasionally, it's about what you don't want to think about. But for the most part, it's our idealized selves. What is the best part of us? And that's what they're selling to. For example, I don't think advertising makes people feel fat, for example. I think people feel fat. And advertising says, you feel fat, don't you? So in the same way, happiness is, it's like if you drive this car, you may be the man that you always wanted to be.
These guys in this show are very successful. They've got great jobs.
Right.
They're top of the world, white American males in,
right.
in 1959, 1960 America. And yet somehow I get the sense that they're not satisfied, that they're looking around saying, wait, is this all there is?
Well, I wrote it when I was 35 years old, and I think it's that point. Is this it? Is this all there is really the question in the show. And it has to do with prosperity and all those things, but it also has to do with where you are in life. You know, when we get our metabolized version of this history of 1960, it's given to us by baby boomers, or this is their childhood, and they see it as a time of innocence before Jack Kennedy came in. They can't imagine a world where Jack Kennedy was running for president and people didn't like him. They cannot understand that there was an almost a kind of existential crisis that goes with success, which says, okay, now I have it. What is my life about?
Do you think if Don Draper were transplanted to 2007 America, he'd recognize the ad industry?
No, I don't think he would. Because why I picked 1960, besides the fact that the pill came out and it is the height of the 50s and it's right before Kennedy's election, was also a huge change in advertising, which is that Don is part of a traditional white guard in advertising, which has a very specific way of selling things. And what happened in 1959, what's considered the benchmark, is the Think Small ad from Volkswagen. It's a subversive advertisement with a sense of humor. It's a stripping away of this all-knowing independent voice. It's a joke about advertising, and it came out of Jews and Italians who were working at other firms who had an immigrant sensibility and said, you know, why are we pretending like we're not trying to sell you something? And that attitude really just changed everything in advertising. So Don is a little bit of the old guard. Don is about this happiness aspect. He's not about making fun of advertising.
There's a visual aspect to this besides the attention to detail, but it's shot in film. If you go out on the set, we saw the Panavision cameras out there. You're shooting in film. Does that add an element of detail and an element of production process for you?
It would have been cheaper to not shoot it on film. And honestly, I had no desire to not shoot it on film. But I will give that credit to AMC. They wanted this show to be able to sit in their lineup with these movies that they're buying. And I just feel that film, for whatever reason, has a reality to it that we have not been able to imitate on video yet. We do manipulate it for dramatic purposes, but in the end, when you see something on film, you do feel like you're there.
The show is called Mad Men. It's by creator and executive producer Matt Weiner. It airs on AMC. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, speaking of advertising, think back to those late-night infomercials and tell me if this sounds familiar.
You're going to get that stainless steel cleaver free if you promise to tell a friend about these knives. But wait, there's more.
Actually, there may not be more for Ronco, maker of the Vegematic and the Popeil pasta maker. The company filed for bankruptcy protection a couple of weeks ago. But take heart, infomercial viewers of the future. Ronco has just found a buyer. Yes, in keeping with the trend on Wall Street, it's a private equity group. Sale price is about $6 million. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 55 points, more than a third of 1%. The Nasdaq dropped 12 points, almost half a percent. The S&P 500 fell 3 points, about two-tenths of 1% there. Our engineers are Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba. Thanks today to the staff here at WAMU. Next time on the program, walking the busy route of a Beijing postman.
When I wake up every morning, the first thing I do is release my pigeons.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.